Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Michelle Obama's commencement address at Tuskegee University stirred emotions over the weekend. The First Lady spoke bluntly about race, resilience, and being black in America. She won cheers for her candor, complaints from critics who said it was too much victimhood. We're listening and still thinking about it today with three African-American women and you. This hour On Point, Michelle Obama's Tuskegee speech on race and being black in America. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What did you think? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, writer Salman Rushdie is at Emory University's class of 2015 graduation talking about the mistakes of his generation, and we will dip into that speech. But first, before my panel joins me today, let's just sit back for a moment and listen to a bit of Michelle Obama. This was at Tuskegee University in Alabama on Saturday. First Lady speaking openly about her experience as a black woman in the White House and in America.
Back when my husband first started campaigning for president, folks had all sorts of questions of me. What kind of First Lady would I be? What kinds of issues would I take on? Would I be more like Laura Bush or Hillary Clinton or Nancy Reagan? And the truth is, those same questions would have been posed to any candidate's spouse. That's just the way the process works. But as potentially the first African-American First Lady, I was also the focus of another set of questions and speculations, conversations sometimes rooted in the fears and misperceptions of others. Was I too loud, or too angry, or too emasculating? Or was I too soft, too much of a mom, not enough of a career woman? Then there was the first time I was on a magazine cover. It was a cartoon drawing of me with a huge afro and a machine gun. Now, yeah, it was satire. But if I'm really being honest, that knocked me back a bit. It made me wonder, well, just how are people seeing me? Or you might remember the onstage celebratory fist bump between me and my husband after a primary win that was referred to as a terrorist fist jab. And over the years, folks have used plenty of interesting words to describe me. One said I exhibited a little bit of uppityism. Another noted that I was one of my husband's cronies of color. Cable News charmingly referred to me as Obama's baby mama.
Cable News charmingly referred to me as Obama's baby mama. Their First Lady, Michelle Obama, at Tuskegee University on Saturday. We're thinking about that speech today and how it's been received around the country in the days since. With a great panel with us from Atlanta, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. Isabel Wilkerson, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you today.
Oh, hi, Tom. Great to be back.
With us from Los Angeles is Sandy Banks. She's a columnist for the Los Angeles Times. Sandy, welcome back to you as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And Terry Franks joins us from Ferguson, Missouri. She's a flight attendant, mother of four boys who we met in the midst of the upheaval last year. Terry Franks, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom, and thank you for having me.
All kinds of response to this. You heard the cheers at Tuskegee University there on Saturday. Pushback as well. Here's Glenn Beck. This was on Monday, criticizing Michelle Obama and her husband for what he says was harping on racism rather than moving the country forward.
They may go down as at least top 10, maybe top 5, of people who had the biggest opportunity in the world in all of history to change things for the better. Mm-hmm. And they decided to go the other way. They could have changed race relations forever. And they took us back to the 1960s.
Terry Franks, Isabel Wilkerson, Sandy Banks, I'll come to you first. There has been all kinds of response to this. And of course, conservative talk radio has only been one strand of it. But as you listened and then looked out and listened to the country and its response to this speech, what were your thoughts, Sandy?
Well, I was kind of puzzled as to why anyone would be surprised or offended that a black first lady spoke at the commencement to black students at Tuskegee, which is the source of some of our proudest history, and that she spoke about race. I'm not sure why that would seem surprising.
It seems logical, you're saying.
Yes, it seems very logical. And the I think it's political. The criticism is political on almost every front. And that offends me, because I think what she said, she was speaking for herself and for many black women and for many black people and trying to prepare these young people to go forward. Her theme seemed to be, as you said, resilience and self-sufficiency and encouragement. And I think the blowback is all about politics and maybe some people who legitimately don't understand the kind of the double duty you feel as a black person in a spot like this.
Rich Lowry writing in Politico today, Isabel Wilkerson, the headline is Michelle Obama's lifetime of microaggressions. The First Lady often strikes an aggrieved note when talking about her experience in America, and that's put forward as a complaint. What have you made of that strand of reaction, Isabel?
Well, I think that we as Americans are accustomed to hearing the voices coming from the White House speaking to the general larger population, the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And I think what she chose to do was to speak directly to the audience in front of her. And this was in the shadow of Baltimore and of Ferguson, these are events that are very fresh in our minds and still in the headlines, even as she was speaking. And she was speaking directly to an audience of people who had saved and scraped and done whatever they could to get their children to this point, to graduation.
Yeah.
She was speaking on, in some ways, hallowed ground of Tuskegee with Booker T. Washington, where he was a scientist. George Washington Carver, rather, was a scientist. Booker T. Washington founded mm-hmm. this institution. The Tuskegee Airmen had trained there. And she chose to speak to people who had been buffeted by the news. And I think that we're not maybe accustomed to hearing her speaking in that way.
Terry Franks, there you are listening in Ferguson, Missouri, watching maybe as well at some point.
Yes.
Flight attendant working out of Ferguson, but we all know what happened in Ferguson over the last year. You've got four boys there, four sons there. When Michelle Obama stands up at Tuskegee and speaks, what's your reaction?
I feel like with Michelle Obama, her experiences are her experiences. You know, she didn't come on there and try to sugarcoat anything. She kept it 100. She kept it real. She said, you know, stay true to yourself. She spoke to the graduates and she let them know how she felt and what she felt growing up and the things she felt that she went through as a black American woman.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like she did a wonderful job. She spoke to them in layman's terms. She spoke to them where they understood things. They understood her. They could relate. A lot of them could relate to her situation.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them will be going through a lot of what she has gone through. And she wanted to make that be known and to tell them no matter what to keep striving forward.
A day of pride there for graduates at the largely black college. As Isabel Wilkerson say, their families work hard to get them there, to get them through. The First Lady is saying, look, for all that, it will not be easy for you out there. Here's Michelle Obama again.
The road ahead is not going to be easy. It never is, especially for folks like you and me. Because while we've come so far, the truth is that those age-old problems are stubborn, and they haven't fully gone away.
Cindy Banks, is that taking the country back to the 1960s, that warning?
No, I think that's recognizing the reality of today. And I could see some people who might say that went on a bit too long and that it began to feel kind of weighty and discouraging on what's supposed to be a celebratory moment. But I think in her mind, I think it was wise of her to link herself to them because she is kind of at the pinnacle. And so if I did this, you could. But also to give them something to hold on to when these things begin happening to them, even if they are as slight as somebody, you know, in the newsroom or the office overlooks you or seems to not see you. And she's given them something to hold on to and kind of go back to. And I think that's a valuable thing.
Isabel, what about the concern that she may be gearing people toward an attitude of victimhood rather than opportunity? What do you say to that vein of critique, Isabel?
Well, I think that looking around ourselves at current events going on right now, we are just coming off the, you know, a series of heart-wrenching, stunning losses. We've seen people die on video, you know, from Eric Garner to Tamir Rice to Michael Brown to the attention that has been rightly given to all of these issues. We have just seen Freddie Gray. All of these things are the world that the families convened there and those young people who are graduating are keenly aware of. They're also entering a world in which studies have shown that there are disparities in employment opportunities based upon studies that show this unconscious bias that still is with us. At the First Lady's own alma mater at Princeton, there's a study that has shown that employers are more likely to hire a white applicant with a felony record than a black applicant with a clean record. And other studies have shown that resumes with black-sounding names are less likely to get a call back than resumes with white-sounding names. These are not impressions and feelings. These are scholarly works that are being done that are proof of the challenges that these young people will be facing. And I think that by her expressing her own challenges and experiences with this gives, in some ways, an inspiration to all of those who are in that audience.
Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns. Please stand by in Atlanta, Georgia. Terry Franks in Ferguson, Missouri. It's great to have you with us. And Sandy Bangs at the Los Angeles Times. So interesting. Here was First Lady Michelle Obama at Tuskegee University. Of course, that's where Marilyn Mosby, the Baltimore state's attorney, who's brought charges against the six police there in the death of Freddie Gray, met her husband, Nick Mosby, both graduates of Tuskegee. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the First Lady, Michelle Obama's Tuskegee commencement speech, her candor, the pushback, and how it all looks to three African-American women watching, listening around the country. Pulitzer Prize winner Isabel Wilkerson is with us, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration, that is, of African-Americans, north from south after World War II. Sandy Banks is with us, columnist for the Los Angeles Times, with us from L.A. today. And Terry Franks, who we met in the aftermath of everything, upheaval in Ferguson, Missouri last year, joins us today from Ferguson. She's a flight attendant, mother of four boys there. Here's Michelle Obama a bit again where she says the problems she faces, has faced, run deep in American society.
I know that these little indignities are obviously nothing compared to what folks across the country are dealing with every single day. Those nagging worries that you're going to get stopped or pulled over for absolutely no reason. The fear that your job application will be overlooked because of the way your name sounds. The agony of sending your kids to schools that may no longer be separate, but are far from equal. The realization that no matter how far you rise in life, how hard you work to be a good person, a good parent, a good citizen, for some folks, it will never be enough.
Applause right there, and pushback on Fox News, America's newsroom. On Monday, here was Deneen Borelli critiquing.
This is identity politics. She's being very divisive, bringing up race on all aspects and all angles. And again, this was a missed opportunity for her to talk about how America is an exceptional country.
Fox had a field day. Fox and Friends Tuesday, Angela McLaughlin.
I think that so many people are critical of her because her husband has utilized race to divide this country, as well as the former Attorney General, Eric Holder. They've used race to divide this country.
Let's hear from our listeners. Anthony in Richmond, Virginia. Anthony, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to comment on Mrs. Obama's remarks at the Tuskegee University, but I wanted to take a few quick seconds to mention Baltimore. I just wanted to say that it was brought up a couple times, and I just wanted to remind everyone that three of the officers charged in the death of Frederick Day were black, so I just wanted to put to bed the myth of
that. Yeah, we know that. We know that. Where are you going, Anthony?
About Mrs. Obama's remarks, I'm deeply disappointed that she chose to stoop the level that she did.
What was stooping about it? Where did you hear stooping?
Because she is the first lady. She's the wife of the most powerful man, probably arguably in the entire world, and she wanted to focus on problems that do exist. But she had an opportunity to be a uniter and someone who spread hope that anything is possible in this great country, and she chose to spread the message of hate and anger and division.
But Anthony, I don't know if you listened to the whole thing. I mean, did you hear the part where she says our history provides us with a better story, a better blueprint for how we can win, we can build ourselves and our communities up, we can take on these deep-rooted problems together, we can overcome anything that stands in our way? That sounds like hope.
But the overwhelming message was that we are living, this country is, you get the impression listening to her that we're living in a country where you have no chance to succeed because of, it's just a big nation of racists, and the only thing they care about doing is holding you back and ignoring you or trying to oppress you. And all the while, she never mentions the fact that we have black president, black attorney general, black Supreme Court justice.
Anthony, we've got it. But I must point out that she was standing there as First Lady of the United States. She said you don't have to be president to start addressing things like poverty. You can mentor a young person. You can volunteer at an after-school program. Do something. Lay the groundwork for future generations. But I hear the way it hit your ear or presented to you, and we'll pick it up, I promise, Anthony. Let me get one more call, and I'll take it to my guest, Marilyn, in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Marilyn, you're on.
Hi. I'll be brief. I just wanted to point out say that there are people who do not understand the wisdom in dealing with racism right now. It is very important that it not be swept under the carpet again. Because it has come to the fore, we have to deal with it. After Ferguson and Baltimore, there is no way we can revert to pretending it doesn't exist. It does exist. And not because we have an African-American president, it means we have no more problems. I think because we have one, the problems have risen come to the fore. Because he's there and because of what he has assailed him as president, we need to discuss these things. We can't push them away anymore.
Marilyn, I appreciate your call as well, very much indeed, and thank you for calling from Fort Lauderdale. Terry Franks, they're back-to-back. Yes. Marilyn says we can't sweep it under the rug. We got to talk about it. But you heard Anthony in Richmond saying, come on, she's First Lady. She could unify us. And instead, he heard her telling these new graduates, you have no chance to succeed in this country.
No, that's not what she said at all. Once again, I want to say her experiences are her experiences. And Michelle Obama dare not speak on race and the things that are going on in these communities today. She dared not speak on that. You know, with the climate today, that needed to be said. It had to be said. I live in Ferguson, Missouri, so I see it every day. She doesn't want these graduates to come out with their degrees and there's a shock factor there. She doesn't want them to think that they have the world in their hands because they've studied hard, they've worked hard, they've done all the right things to get to where they are, and for their dreams to be crushed by society or by how the establishment views them. She's getting them ready. She's letting them know there's going to be a shock factor there. I don't want you to give up. You keep your head high. You strive forward. You keep moving forward. You stay true to the core of yourself. You know, you keeping it real. Once again, keep it real. Keep it 100. Stay true to yourself. Mm-hmm. That's what she was saying.
Isabel, join us here. You hear in Anthony, he wants a first lady, even an African-American first lady, who sort of raises up the positive message about America and always puts that front and center. He sees a kind of a, you know, tearing down or negative quality in what Michelle Obama described. What about that role? I mean, she is a very prominent figure, the wife of the leader of the nation. What about her responsibilities in a moment like this?
I think that her message and her life are proof that this country is a place of opportunity for all people. That is what her entire life and her husband's life represent. I think
yes.
that in this case, you know, it's the current climate and the circumstances of our country that have made this front and center. She's responding to something that cannot be ignored. We are still recovering from the issues of Baltimore, even as we speak, which followed North Charleston, South Carolina, which followed Eric Garner, and you keep going back and going back and going back. And so these are issues that are front and center in our country and in the headlines as we speak. But one of the things that I wanted to mention is that these issues for these families that she was speaking to, these are matters of life and death. I am so reminded of the case of Jonathan Farrell, who we never hear that much about. But this was someone who was a recent graduate of FAMU, Florida A&M, another HBCU. He was in a horrific car accident, and he went to get help after getting had to actually crawl out of the back of his car. That's okay. How bad the car accident was. Mm-hmm. He went to get help. The neighbor that he went to actually called the police instead of helping, and that's understandable in its own way. But she called the police, and the police came, and instead of helping him, they shot him 11 times and killed him. So that means that in the circumstances that these young people are graduating into, this is a world that can, in a minute, in a moment, change and be a matter of life and death because of people's assumptions, because of the unconscious bias, because of circumstances and stereotypes and assumptions that still exist and persist in our country.
Address them. Yes. Speak to them. You said Carolyn in Breeding, Kentucky. Carolyn, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Personally, I was very, very inspired by Michelle's speech. My parents raised 9 children near Detroit, Michigan, and we were raised literally without any kind of prejudice. We were free to choose our own friends all through school, through college, and I'm proud to say that my children feel the same. Michelle was honest. She was being honest. And I really respect her for that. I think the problem that I hear with so many of your listeners is they are listening to her, but they are not hearing her. And I think that we all need to learn to really listen to what is being said, all of it, with an open mind, and then we can go forward.
Listen and listen with an open mind. Carolyn, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. One more right here from New York, Wendy in Vermontville. Wendy, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Hearing both Mrs. Obama and her various critics from the Fox News, et cetera, I am a white woman, 67-year-old professional white woman, and I have worked closely with black professional women. I thank Mrs. Obama for being honest with sharing her experience, and I feel that the response from our conservative friends is nothing but white privilege speaking and racism and a desire to go back to the 50s, not even the 60s. But to say that she dragged us back to the 60s, I guess just shows their inability to understand the reality for many black people today. And as a white person, I apologize and just want it known that not all white people think or feel as represented in the conservative news.
Wendy, I appreciate your call very much. Sandy Banks, here's a couple, Barack and Michelle Obama, who have risen right to the top of the political world. And throughout the president, the two terms, we've felt this balancing act, the president in particular, the need to lead all and the need to speak out on issues of race. Do you see a difference in the way Michelle has handled that from the way the president has handled that, Sandy?
Not well. The
The First Lady was free in this moment to speak from her heart and her mind and not have to make political calculations. And so I think that is what, you know, allowed her to speak so passionately. And I think that Wendy got it right when she talked about, you know, some of the listeners are still living in a previous time. And I think when I heard, listened to Anthony talk about what she said, I think he must have heard the Fox News clips, because the entire first quarter or maybe third of her speech was devoted to the dignity of the Tuskegee Airmen and the example they set of rising above. And it was in no way divisive. And I think there is a sense among many people in this country that they want to control Michelle. They want to control the president. They're personally insulted when there are things that they are uncomfortable with. And to expect that her job on this day was to be some kind of a cheerleader or do a commercial for the America that we wish we had, I think reflects the sense of the people who are judging her and not her speech.
She talked about how Booker T. Washington and the students actually helped build the university, helped make the bricks to build the university. That's initiative.
Self-sufficiency. Yeah, that's an example of self-sufficiency. That's not victimhood. I'm not sure where, you know, everybody keeps talking about victimhood. She talked about resilience and being self-sufficient and trusting yourself, not letting people pull you off track. You know, it was a perfect message for these students who are going out into the world, knowing all that's stacked against them, but also needing the ability to believe in their own accomplishments, in their own minds, in their own determination.
But she didn't sugarcoat it either. Here she talked about how she and her husband have experienced racial stereotyping.
We both felt the sting of those daily slights throughout our entire lives. The folks who crossed the street in fear of their safety. The clerks who kept a close eye on us in all those department stores. The people at formal events who assumed we were the help. And those who have questioned our intelligence, our honesty, even our love of this country.
Rose in Council Bluffs, Iowa. Rose, you're on the air right after the First Lady there.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a pleasure to talk to you. We listen to you every morning.
Great.
I feel that we have gotten way off to the left in the United States. We elect these people into office. Excuse my voice. I've got a cold.
It's okay.
And then we become very critical. First of all, it's our job to mobilize all of us, no matter what race or religion we are. We are the most powerful nation in the United States. And in the end, we have to respect the opinions of other people. And why do we sit and pick apart Mrs. Obama's attitude, what she says? I think we ought to respect the fact that she's coming from an honest place and that our president is doing the best that he can. Take a look at him. He looks tired, worn out, and he's turned gray, just like all the rest of them.
A little respect, you say, Rose. A little respect.
A little. A more respect, because we're going to answer to a higher power one day, all of us. We're here to learn. And if we're not learning the right thing, we will become accountable. There will be a time. And the thing is, why don't we learn from each other? I don't understand the attitude of tearing one race down against another, one religion down. If people just stopped for 1 minute throughout the world and didn't do anything bad to anybody, what do you think would happen?
It wouldn't be too bad. Rose, we've got it. Your voice delivers that just fine, thank you. I mean, Isabel, it is unusual, though, for Americans to hear a First Lady talk with that kind of passion about having her and her husband's intelligence question, their honesty question, even our love of this country. And you can hear anger in her voice.
You can also hear the response from the audience, that when she makes those comments that speak directly to the experiences, the lived experience, the lived reality of people who are really suffering under the many, many disparities in wealth and education and unemployment, that they are responding to that because that is what they have experienced themselves.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the First Lady Michelle Obama's Tuskegee University commencement speech last weekend with Sandy Banks of the Los Angeles Times, Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, Terry Franks out of Ferguson, Missouri. Sandy's in L.A., Isabel's in Atlanta. Before this hour is over, we will hear some of Salman Rushdie's commencement address on Monday of this week at Emory University in Atlanta. But right here, a little more from the First Lady. This was at Tuskegee, of course, historic black university there, Booker T. Washington, and much more in its proud history. The Tuskegee Airmen, many of them trained right there and off for a very famous era in fighting in World War II. Here she was, Michelle Obama, saying racism can weigh on a person, can weigh on the grads.
All of that is going to be a heavy burden to carry. It can feel isolating. Can make you feel like your life somehow doesn't matter, that you're like the invisible man that Tuskegee grad Ralph Ellison wrote about all those years ago. And as we've seen over the past few years, those feelings are real. They're rooted in decades of structural challenges that have made too many folks feel frustrated and invisible. And those feelings are playing out in communities like Baltimore and Ferguson and so many others across this country.
The First Lady calling those locales out by name, those conflicts out by name. But she also said, it's important to remember, we need you to channel the magic of Tuskegee toward the challenges of today. She said, you have got everything you need to do this. You've got it in you. She said, I want you to realize that you've got everything you need right now to succeed. You've got it. John in Burlington, Connecticut, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I heard one of your guests mention at the beginning of the hour how she was offended by some of the reaction to the Tuskegee speech. From hearing her speak, I'd be interested to know when is the last day she got through a day without being offended. And I'll tell you another thing. As a white male, a middle-aged, blue-collar white male, go-to-work-every-day type of person, there's a bunch of people just like me that are tired of hearing how bad they are. And you're turning off a huge voting block. You know, everybody has trials and tribulations, and the people that go to work every day and aren't writing news articles and on radio programs are getting kind of tired of it.
But what do you mean? Do you mean that this First Lady, the first African-American First Lady, shouldn't talk about these issues if she sees them?
She should not. She's the wife of the president who represents the whole country, and it's very divisive. I'm going to tell you right now, I consider myself a Democrat, and I'm tired of hearing how bad I am, how good I have it, and how bad everybody else has it, when that's not the case. And it's really puts a bad taste in my mouth, and a lot of people that I know.
John, I appreciate your call. Isabel Wilkerson, respond. There's John. He doesn't feel too privileged, and he wants to hear, I guess, a kind of a unifying voice that takes his problems just as fully into account as anybody else's.
Well, when we look at the history of our country, this is not a question of individual people being good or bad, or one group being good and one group being bad. This is about a structure and a history in a country in which over generations and generations and generations, there have been differences in how people have been treated, and therefore we are now living with the after effects of that. I mean, one of them is that the families of those children, those young people who were graduating on that day at Tuskegee, that hallowed ground, you might say, of history and confluence of history. Those people are families where they're experiencing tremendous wealth disparities in such a way that makes it difficult for them to even get their children to that point. So as an example, generations of Jim Crow have led to these gaping wealth disparities, which means that the average white family, regardless of where they might happen to be in terms of personal circumstances, but the average white family has wealth of up to 19 times that of their black counterpart. So that with all things being considered, income and standing and all of that, white families, because of the historic generational transfer of wealth over time and the history of differences of being treated differently during Jim Crow and all of our history, we are now living at a time where the wealth disparity is so great that for those families that she was speaking about, they had to save and scrape whatever they could to get their children there. And life is difficult for all people. No one has a perfect life. But in these situations, we're speaking about structural disparities that have been inherited over time that families that, such as those that she was speaking to are living every day with. And their response to her talk is in some ways an affirmation. It was a referendum on the lived reality that she was speaking to.
But Sandy Banks, here's John calling saying, look, he doesn't want to hear about it. It's grating. And Isabel speaks to gaping wealth disparities. Well, of course, there are gaping wealth disparities between whites at this point as well, Sandy.
Well, I think John was referring to me when he said about being offended because I am offended by the political reaction, just as he's offended by the speech, I think. I think it's important to understand that, as Isabel said, she was speaking to these people and these family and these graduating seniors, and maybe this wasn't for you, John. This was a speech that was intended to address certain issues, and there was nowhere in it where he said, oh, white people, she said, white people have it made, or everything's great for, you know, the people
True.
On the other side.
Yep.
That message wasn't there, and if it was heard, it's being filtered through the perceptions of people who I think are unhappy that we still have to talk about race, and we do, as an entire country, not just as black people.
Go to Travis in Homestead, Florida. Travis, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes, how you doing?
Okay.
Yes, my comment is, all I hear is positivity from that message. What she was saying is, no matter what the odds are, no matter how the deck is stacked against you, it reminds me of Maya Angelou, I rise. And I'm a father of five sons, and I tell them the challenges they're going to face out there in life, but you still just have to try harder and you have to do better. You're going to be a doctor, you make sure you be the best doctor. You're going to be a lawyer, you make sure you be the best lawyer, because you have some things stacked against you for your race and your color that you have to try a little harder to succeed. And that's what I hear her telling those graduates.
Try a little harder and remember Maya Angelou's exhortation or words, and still I rise in spite of all that. Travis, I appreciate your call. One more right here, Cherokee, Oklahoma. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, I appreciate Michelle Obama's speech. I think she spoke up for people that needed to be spoke up for. Kids are all taught, you know, in schools that, you know, cliques, you know, to join cliques. And I think parents kind of preserve that, and it's a way to get ahead in life. And I think it doesn't matter if you're black or white or whatever. I think we all have that to go through that, and we seem to preserve that as we get older. But I see more division now in our country because people are getting more clannish because of the economy, and it doesn't matter if you're black or white. It's hard to fit in. It's hard to get a piece of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I can see it's harder for black people because you have something that you have color. You stand out more.
Yep.
So it's harder to fit in to these cliques, and I'm terrible. Terribly sorry, as an American that we've treated you this way, and I apologize for that. But I do think it needs to be spoken about, and I do really believe that it's you know, in the black communities that they got to figure out a way to like she said, to mentor the kids, and in the end, the kids that are the innocent ones. We're the ones that destroy everything, and the message, we somehow need to keep the message strong. And what she's doing is talking to these young people that, you know, And I appreciate what she was doing.
Mike, you sound like a wise man, and I appreciate your call from Cherokee, Oklahoma. I want to get one more. Christopher, Augusta, Georgia. Christopher, thank you for calling. You're on.
Oh, thank you for accepting my call. Mm-hmm. I listened to what Ms. Obama had to say, and there's a big part of me that agreed. But at the same time, I just want to bring to the forefront of things. What we see going on throughout America isn't something that is new. However, it's an individual thing when it comes down to an individual being killed. What I am taken aback by is we see this going on constantly throughout many of our minority communities. And there are too many black men, I'm African-American myself, mm-hmm. that does nothing. So there's a broken moral compass that exists. However, at the same time, there is no proactivity, okay, or reactivity until white America seems to do something against black America. So that is my greatest downfall. I kind of object to that simply because unless there is an ongoing and educated movement within the communities, within our minority communities, for men to take their position to educate and to show what it means to have morals or good morals and ethics, then that's going to always be this breakdown. And unfortunately, I would like to equate us to, you know, somehow at times the way we get bogged down in these situations when a black American is killed by, you know, a white American.
Christopher, let us pick it up while we have the time. I just have a couple of minutes with my panel here. Isabel, is Christopher with the call for black men to step up and show a moral compass and lead their children? Well, it's really a black woman who was speaking here today. Did you hear that call from her?
Well, I would like to focus in on the people in the audience. I had the opportunity to speak at my own alma mater at Howard University at the commencement a few years ago.
Yeah.
And I so wish that every American could have the opportunity to attend one of these magnificent graduations, which is where she spoke, speaking at mm-hmm. an HBCU in that way, and to see in the audience from the day as
historically black college or university.
Historically
yeah.
black mm-hmm. colleges. To look out in the audience and to see a sea of thousands of graduates and their parents and their grandparents, aunts and uncles, and all of them all invested in success and in achievement all that our country has to offer. And this is actually the opposite of victimhood. This is an embrace of all that is possible in our country.
Sandy Banks, I don't know where to take it exactly. What would you say to Michelle Obama as she looks at the last couple of years of her time as First Lady here and the most important message for her to deliver?
I don't think she needs my advice, Tom. I think she's doing a great job right now. and I would like to say just to the gentleman that spoke from Augusta, Georgia, mm-hmm. there are movements in black communities around the country led by men, led by women, to mentor and educate and encourage young black people. They don't make the headlines. I know we have them here in Los Angeles. I presume they're in Atlanta and in Ferguson as well. And they're working miracles every day and really difficult streets and difficult circumstances, but they don't get the attention. So that is going on. And it will continue, and these young graduates of Tuskegee, I imagine, will be leading some of those same efforts as they grow up with their own families and in their own communities.
We've got to wrap it right there. Sandy Banks with the Los Angeles Times, thank you so much. Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns. Terry Franks, our friend from Ferguson, Missouri. Our thanks to all three of you. Thank you very much for being with us today. In a moment, writer Salman Rushdie tells the class of 2015 to go out there and swallow the world. This is On Point. On Monday this week, award-winning author Salman Rushdie addressed 4,500 new graduates at Emory University in Atlanta. He said they shared something in common, as this was his final year at the school after 8 years as distinguished writer in residence there. The 67-year-old writer, who is also an atheist, told graduates to look beyond religion and apologized for the mistakes of his generation.
My generation, we have not made such a good fist of our time on Earth. And it's right, I think, that I apologize to you publicly for the mess we are leaving. the whole ecological, fanatical, oligarchic mess in which 1% of the country gets everything, while kids are being killed daily for the crime of being black, in which religious bigots in this country think Jesus wants them not to sell cupcakes to gay couples, while religious bigots elsewhere think their God approves of sawing off the heads of innocent men. We thought of ourselves, my lot, as tolerant and progressive, and we are leaving you an intolerant and retrogressive world. There's a story by Kurt Vonnegut in which God reveals to the hero of the story that the human race was an experiment that hasn't worked out very well, and all he can do is say, oops, sorry. Well, I'm not God, as you'll have noticed, on account of he doesn't exist. But I'd like to say sorry, too. But it's a resilient place, the world, and its beauty is still breathtaking, its potential still astonishing. And as for the mess we've made, you can change it. And I believe you're going to. I have a suspicion you're better than us. You care more for the planet. You're less bigoted, more tolerant, and your ideals may hold up better than ours did. Make no mistake, you can change things. Don't believe anyone who tells you that you can't. Here's how to do it. Question everything. Take nothing for granted. Argue with all received ideas. Don't respect what doesn't deserve respect. Speak your mind. Don't censor yourselves. Use your imagination and express what it tells you to express. You have been given all these tools by your education here on this beautiful campus. Use them. These are the weapons of the mind. Think for yourself and don't let your mind run along tram lines someone else laid down. We are language animals. We are dreaming creatures. So dream, speak, reinvent the world. Happy Commencement Day.
Salman Rushdie speaking Monday to graduates at Emory University in Atlanta. For a full video, go to our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.